So do we have, are we recording?
I just started the tape, so we're ready to roll.
Okay, so call to order at 6:03, Administrative Control Board for Mountain Regional Special Service District. And let's go to agenda item one.
Yeah, do we have any public input this evening? Chris, anybody joining us?
Nope, it is just the board and staff tonight.
Okay. Ian, if you don't mind, I just wanted to take a minute and recognize Bob Neumeister. You know, Bob was a great man. I think he was a pleasure to work with, and I think we all learned from Bob. Unfortunately, he passed away you know, 2+ weeks ago now. And I think the board probably received my email. But I just wanted to take a moment, recognize him, and let the board know that we did send Bob's wife, Marianne, a card. We also did provide a donation in his honor to the Nature Conservancy. So just wanted to let everybody know that. Secondly, hang on, we've got Mike calling. I'm going to put myself on mute.
Yep.
Hey, Mike, can you hear me?
Trying to sign in, but I'm not finding an invite to the meeting.
The Zoom link is in the agenda. Let me...
I'll just add in while Scott's on mute.
Let me send it to you directly, Mike. Do you want it to your...
the Mount Regional.
Your Brown and Caldwell email? Is that easiest?
It's always a pleasure working with them. And what was great was he seemed to really enjoy what he did.
And,
I mean,
Mountain Regional, okay.
A lot of us can kind of share. And
just bear with me a sec. I'll send it to you.
That glow in the corner of his eye. And you knew something was coming. So it was a lot of fun to work with.
I like the fact that he had the amount of experience that he has, and everybody has, a lot of people have experience, but he had a way of putting that experience to good use. I think he was a pretty quick study on the stuff that was put in front of him by Steve and whatnot. And Steve, I think you found that he could pick through the details pretty quickly, but in looking at his resume that he had in his obituary, he was... very, very accomplished before any of us probably met him.
Yeah, he was quite impressive. And then, like you said, him reading his resume, even more impressed. He really had done a lot and accomplished a lot during his life. And you're right, I think Lisa and I both picked up on, yeah, he sees right to the heart of an issue real quick and gave good input always, so...
I think only Karen really knew what he was talking about half the time.
Mike, it's on its way.
I'm glad I got the email before I read it in the paper on Saturday. It just caught me by surprise, and I can't believe that we're not going to see him anymore. It breaks my heart a little bit.
Yeah, it was sad too, reading through, you know, this month's packet and seeing that at the last meeting, you know, he was listed as absent. But
I don't know if anybody on the call here ever read the Park City Record where he wrote that letter to the editor about the killing of those elk. They're out in his part of the woods there.
And Mike, have you seen that come through yet?
Passionate about wildlife. Okay. And wrote quite a long letter to the editor about the senselessness of all that. I don't know if others saw that, but he did write something to the Park Record.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was incredibly senseless. I still drive by the Eco Center and wish the elk were still out there, right?
All right, I think we successfully brought Mike in. Just kind of following up on the tribute to Bob, I wanted to just take a moment and welcome Joel Fine. I think we're extremely fortunate to have Joel on board. Joel was appointed to our board last week with Ian. Ian for a second term, Joel obviously for his first. Joel, do you want to just take a minute and introduce yourself and maybe a bit about your background? You're on mute, just so you know.
A couple of things. I talk a little funny because I had a stroke, but rest assured that I'm all there. I'm also a member of the Centerville Basin Planning Commission, and I'll ask a lot of questions. I'll try not to be too much of a pain in the ass. I have a bachelor's, I have a master's. I've been here since 2005. I'm also the president and the CEO of Recycle Utah. I come with a lot of experience. But I'm pretty quiet, and I'll ask a lot of questions. I probably won't say a lot.
That sounds great, Joel.
I can take any questions that you might have.
Where was home before Park City, Joel?
Florida. I came from Florida. I was there for quite a long time, and I was in HR for quite a number of years before becoming a realtor. And I'm a realtor here in Park City.
What part of Florida?
West Palm Beach.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds great, Joel.
Was your education background, Joel, and was that in HR as well, your undergrad and master's degree?
Yes, psychology and labor and industrial relations from the University of Illinois.
Is that where you grew up, that part of the world?
I grew up in Michigan, but I lived all over, most recently, obviously, Florida, and I came from West Palm in 2005.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for that, Joel. With that, Mike, we will turn it back to you. We have gone through calling the meeting to order, and we do not have any public comment this morning, so we're on to agenda item 2.
Hey, do we need to go into the executive session tonight?
We do not tonight.
Okay. So item 3 is the consent agenda. It's like we've got the minutes, the check register. I saw a couple of POs. So did anybody have comments to the minutes?
None for me.
None for Tim.
Karen?
No comments on the minutes. I had a question on the check register.
Well, that's perfect timing. Why don't we just go straight into that?
Well, I noticed that we paid like $40,000 for legal, but then there was we also paid some county like $333,000 for a reconstruction project, and I just wondered what that was.
Yeah, I can.
$40,000 is our yearly annual contract with Summit County for the legal services and support we receive. The $330,000, maybe Brian, you want to speak to that? That was the Summit Park project that Summit County was doing that we kind of piggybacked on, so we didn't have to go through and dig up the streets again, where we were able to do a lot of improvements at a lower cost because of doing it at the same time or being part of that project.
Was that in our capital budget already?
Yeah, it was for last year.
Okay.
It was a phase 6 of ongoing every other year project.
Okay. Great. That's all I had.
The $40,000 enables Dave to support us, which we're thankful for.
Oh no, I thought the $40,000 was fine. That was it was the other one that just it wasn't clear what it was for.
Karen, are you sure you don't want to argue with Dave about the dollar amount on that?
Hey, you know, I'd take less. But my boss wouldn't.
All right. I'll behave myself, sorry.
All right, any other questions on the check register?
I've got one question. It's a minor issue on here. Is that I saw this from Smith Harvigson. that there was a $52 charge, and I went in and I was taking a look at your report, Steve, about having Smith Harvickson look at the insurance. But $52 an hour from a legal firm, is that like...
You know, I know the charge to review the insurance is more. I
can take that.
Because that bill, then we didn't pay till January, so it's not in the December check register.
That was probably a water rights issue, and the bill on the quarter of an hour or half of an hour. So that's probably what it was, right, Scott?
Yeah, that's correct, Lisa. Tim, the Jeffrey Giddens is represents us from Smith Harvickson. He does. Various just general tasks, checking water rights database, keeping up on proof due notices for Mountain Regional. So to Lisa's point, it was probably a 15 or a 30 minute activity that was on his end.
Okay. No problem.
I guess the big one is the $1.8 million to Weber Basin for water rights.
Yep, that's our annual check that we cut to Weber Basin for all the exchange, all the leases, right? All the exchange rights that we have with them.
Yes. Yeah, all these, yes.
Okay.
Just a minute.
Are there any other questions to the check register?
I think Joel has some, but I've got some. I could go first.
Go for it, Ian.
On the 17th, there was a charge, a drug test, and it said it was associated with two accidents. I'm just, wondering, is everybody okay with those accidents?
Yeah, that was Mike when he backed the dump truck into a landscaping rock up in Spring Creek. I can't remember, Glen Wild or Stagecoach up there somewhere. And the other one was for the Dixon accident, which I think we've discussed before, going up to the Olympic Park, where he rear-ended somebody who hadn't pulled fully off the road.
Okay, so everybody's good. Okay,
yeah. Cool. Yeah, everybody's good.
And then this one, I'm sure it's minor, but so there was two charges from Rocky Mountain for the Lost Canyon Booster Station, one for $74 and then one for, like, $26,900. Is there a reason there was two charges for Lost Canyon in 1 month? Do they bill on like a 15-day cycle or something? Or
no, the Lost Canyon bill, the big bill is about that, let's say $20,000 plus a month to run the power. There's a little, what I'm thinking is either a description that wasn't right. There's a little bill that comes in, or there's one item on the large bill with all the other items that we attribute to Lost Canyon as well. So The okay. Booster, the real one is the $20,000+ bill.
Okay. That's it on the check register for me. I think Joel, did you have a check register question?
Joel, you're on mute.
Joel, I think you're on mute.
A couple of things. My general question is, are we being very as judicious as possible with all the different charges? I mean, I know there's a lot of supplies and what have you, but are we being judicious enough with all the expenses? I'm not saying we're spending foolishly, but by the same token, I'm just asking the question.
Yeah, I can take that, Joel. I think I have a couple points on that. One is that all charges by staff are reviewed by the supervisors and then up through board review of the check register. So, you know, we're comfortable with the charges that are being made. And I think secondly, just to kind of give you a point of reference from last year, we were under budget overall with respect to our expenses. So I think hopefully those two points kind of provide some comfort.
Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Steve, was this a record month for checks?
So dollar amount it might have been. I actually didn't compare, but when you talk about, because the Weaver Basin lease fees go up a little bit more, we did have a couple of really big projects finish up, like that Summit Park restoration. Yeah, so it might have been. In the report, you'll notice that the cash dropped by over $3 million, but it's all planned. We save up during the year for our big December spend out to pay Weaver Basin and pay all our debt payments that are due in December. But I had not looked, but I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't a record amount for cash going out in a month. So,
there was a lot of checks, and it added up to like $3.8 million. Like,
yeah, wow. I know when I got that total, I was like, wow, that's a lot of money.
we didn't pay.
What? I'm sorry.
Tim, we lost you there for a second. If you're with us, go ahead and go for it. If not, we can move on and circle back. Chris, just a heads up, Karen does need to be promoted if you didn't see her chat message. Looks like we Tim dropped off at the moment. Mike, do you want to, we'll just continue forward.
Yep. So I think the next one is the POs. We got two trucks and a ditch witch.
Yep.
Yeah, so just for it's like Joel, just for your understanding, there's a couple trucks on the that are up on POs this month. This is a purchase that's typically done in January. This is an expected purchase as part of our capital budget.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for the explanation.
And the ditch witch will replace them having to rent one anytime they need. It's a large vacuum trailer they can haul around, so when they're in a hole, it can suck out the mud and the water and things like that. So they did quite a bit of research in finding that and tested out a few and decided this would be the best. So they're very excited to get that in-house.
Yeah, the distribution crew has been asking for this piece of equipment for a number of years now. This was a planned expense as well.
Ditch, which has typically been a kind of a industry name, is so this is not a trencher, this is a vacuum truck?
Yeah, it's a vacuum excavator. Tim, I had the same confusion when they started talking about it, you know, this ditch witch. But obviously that's just a brand. They make equipment that, you know, performs various functions.
Okay. But it specifically lowers your risk of hitting other utilities, right? Because you're using a water flow to cut the surface and recirculate solid materials out of the hole. So if there are any utilities that weren't marked appropriately, we don't hit a gas main or something. So it's yeah, fully supported by me. I think it's great.
Yep, that's exactly right, Ian. All right, any other questions on that, on the POs?
Is there an opportunity to share this with Snyderville Basin Water Rec or Park City for utility locates? I know that happens sometimes, or we rent back to them or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if they need it, I know the Reclamation District has at least one of these. They have, this is a trailer. I believe theirs are full truck type styles. We have borrowed them in the past from other excavation companies. So I think across the providers here locally, Mike, I think, you know, people make those calls if they need something, and we're happy to share it. I think from a regular sharing to get, sharing in the cost, I don't expect that we'll see that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions on the purchase orders? So do we need a motion to approve these purchases?
Yep, a motion to approve the consent agenda, including the purchase orders.
I move to approve the purchase orders and consent agenda.
The second.
Second.
Okay, that motion was Karen, and the second by Tim. All those in favor, aye.
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 Okay, that was unanimous. I guess you guys will send that over to me in the morning.
Yep.
Steve will do that. OK. Okay. I think we're ready for item four and an update to the COVID leave policy by Lisa Hoffman.
Yep. We have an amendment to the COVID-19 sick leave policy that we would like to put in front of you for recommendation to Summit County Council. A little background, the federally mandated sick leave expired at the end of December on 31/20. Last week, Summit County Tom Fisher did an executive order to extend the sick leave available to Summit County employees through Summit County's emergency declaration order date, which, correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, but I believe that was just adopted last night to go through June 16th of 2021.
June 30th.
Oh, is it June 30th? Okay, sorry. Mountain Regional would like to adopt that same policy that Summit County has and extend the sick leave policy for our employees related to COVID through that June 30th date. The red line that you have essentially are the same exact changes that Summit County made to their policy. We're just asking for your recommendation so that we can then take that to Summit County Council as soon as possible to get it approved. If you're okay with that or have any questions.
Does anybody need that document shared on the screen? Chris can do that if we need it. Everybody's got it handy.
Lisa, did any of the red lines come out of that seminar that you went to, workplace seminar on COVID-19?
No, that was more related to vaccine and how that's going to be incorporated in the workplace. This just strictly came from Summit County's direction and the need with that federal sick leave policy expiring and thus our sick leave policy expiring at the same time. We had it also running through December 31st, 2020. We needed to decide what we wanted to do, and the county wanted to move ahead and continue that program. So this is strictly Summit County, nothing related to that.
And just for Joel's education, Joel, on the personnel side and really across a lot of our policies, we follow Summit County's lead. Many of our policies are, a mirror image of Summit County's with some minor language changes that reflect the district. So this is us, again, following Summit County's lead on this.
Thank you. Was the penalty for not being vaccinated, is that a county penalty with regards to losing the leave if you don't get vaccinated? Because that seemed a little odd to me.
I mean, you can talk further, but from what I understand, this has been Rich Bola has definitely made this kind of one of the stipulations, and I believe this is also coming from the state, that if you have the ability to become vaccinated and you choose not to do so, that you will then be, you don't get to continue with that priority. If you decide you want it the next week, you go back in kind of with the general population when it's available to them.
But are we going to deviate from the county in this regards? Because don't we consider ourselves to be an essential service?
Are you talking with respect to the timing of vaccine, Tim, or are you talking about?
No, I was looking at there was a red line. I don't have the document in front of me, but there was a red line in there that was saying if an employee is available for being vaccinated and they choose not to, then they're basically forfeiting these leave benefits.
Yeah. So essentially, that's correct, Tim. So essentially, as Lisa touched on, this is not a federally mandated leave program anymore. This is a benefit that Summit County is providing to employees. And I think the thought process here is that if an employee decides not to get vaccinated for COVID-19 and then they contract it or they need time away from work as a result of COVID, that they are not eligible for the county's leave program.
But it didn't say that, though. It wasn't that they had to contract COVID. It was just that they chose not to be vaccinated.
Chris, can you bring the document up?
It just says you lose the benefit. It's not tied to.
Yeah, I think you just, you if you become eligible and you fail to be vaccinated for COVID-19 within 7 weeks of becoming eligible, then you just lose the benefit of the COVID policy.
The leave granted.
The leave.
So my question is Mountain Regional considered to be an essential service within the county?
As at this time, essential employees, we have delivered to Tom and Rich the priority that we would like to see for our employees, but and it basically correlates with similar employee tiers that Summit County's using. We are under federal guidelines deemed essential employees, but it's my understanding that we currently don't have a priority, you know, that group is different for different states.
I would say to answer Tim's question, yes, we are deemed essential, but there's a pecking order within that essential worker category. And we are aligned with respect to Summit County. We are aligned effectively with their public works type activities. And as Lisa,
the only issue I had here is that within the narrow confines of being an employee,
Tim, we lost your audio again.
Chooses to not be vaccinated, is that another issue for us? Or am I making too much out of this, Scott?
We lost you there for a bit, Tim. Do you want to just try to repeat that?
Well, the question I have is that this is narrowly discussing the let's call it a benefit of a leave policy, but if we expand it to an essential service and we have an employee that is refusing to be vaccinated, is that a different action that we're talking about, or do we start dabbling into an area that Dave might say it's in a an employee's right issue?
Yeah.
It does. That's the reason why the county's policy simply deals with a benefit that the employees could get as long as they follow the policy. So they don't follow the policy, they don't get vaccinated when they can, then they lose this specific benefit, but it doesn't affect anything else. Okay. You can't take disciplinary action against them. Yeah. Can't do anything else. It's just they lose this ability with regard to sick leave.
And Dave, just to be clear, I mean, we can't force employees to be vaccinated, correct? I mean, that's their choice.
Yeah, we can't force them.
Force them either.
All we can do is, I mean, this is a incentive, basically.
Okay. Not a disincentive, it's an incentive.
And it really doesn't affect their essential services categorization.
No.
Well, if we have the rest of the employees vaccinating and we have one employee that's not vaccinating, then you might consider that we've accomplished what we want to accomplish, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
would we keep that one employee from not interacting with the public at that point, though, or?
Nope, Karen,
well,
you know. Go for it, Lisa. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say this was part of the webinar that I attended last week. They talked a lot about having a mandatory or a voluntary vaccination program. I consider ours to be a voluntary program, a mandatory program. You'd have to start giving people, you can't force people to do it. They could, under the ADA, ask for accommodations, and then you could accommodate that person by having them, you know, with PPE that they would have to wear, and they would have to, the employer would have to provide accommodations for those, for that individual who chose not to be vaccinated. We're doing a voluntary vaccination. From what I can tell, I can ask the employee if they have been vaccinated. But that's really the extent of what, I can do. If we're doing a voluntary program, we're not doing a mandatory program.
Does HIPAA prevent you from telling other employees who or who has not been vaccinated?
Yes.
Yes.
But at some point, we're going to have to ask if they've been vaccinated to see if they qualify for the leave benefit.
I can ask, but I cannot disseminate the information.
Yeah.
This is Joel. Do we have any idea what our exposure is? I mean, are there a lot of anti-vaxxers? Just a general question.
With respect to the number of employees we expect to not vaccinate, Joel?
Yeah.
You can't ask.
Yeah, I really don't. We have a diverse staff from different areas of the county. It's tough to really pin that down.
Well, it sure would be nice to know what our exposure is so we can plan accordingly. That's just my opinion.
I can give you kind of a general idea of what they're seeing across the state, and that's about one third that are not being, that are refusing from being vaccinated. About a third.
Hey, wow. Brian, do you have the pulse on the operations team? Certainly without, talking specifically about any names or anything like that. Have you heard discussions about people saying absolutely not?
I would expect a handful of employees probably won't, but the pulse that I'm getting is a lot of them want to wait more or less to see what side effects are. I have heard that a little bit.
Okay. Thanks, Brian.
Hey, is there any way that this could extend to the board? This.
Yeah. Hey, if anybody refuses to get their vaccination, give me a call, okay? And let me know what their name is so I can go and stand in line for them.
I do have a client who's like on the board of a hospital, and somehow he got the vaccine. So it's not a
Well, there was a big story on one of the national news of the board for a lot of these long-term care or assisted living type facilities that all of the board flew from New York to like some place in Iowa or something like that and all got vaccinated at one of their facilities, then flew back to New York. So, yeah. I don't know if we want to make the news, though.
any further questions?
No,
If not, Mike, just to be clear, it is a recommendation for approval to the Summit County Council for our COVID-19 leave policy.
There's no more questions. I think we're ready for a motion.
I move to approve the new policy.
Recommend to the council to approve the new policy.
Oh, I move to recommend to the council to approve the new policy.
Thanks, Karen. Ian seconded.
Okay, all those in favor, aye.
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 Okay, that's unanimous.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for putting that together for our staff and keeping us in line with the county. All right, item 5 is an overview of our cross-connection control program.
Yeah, I'd like to just invite Stacy in, and I want to welcome Stacy. So for those that don't know Stacy, Stacy's been with the district almost since the beginning, and she leads our cross-connection control program. So Stacy, take it away. Currently muted. There you go.
Okay.
Now I need to share my screen. Okay, before we get started, would you guys like me to go through the slides, or do you just want me to stick with the frequently asked questions?
Yeah. And Mike, that's maybe a follow-up to your call earlier today. Mike had some comments about just keeping the overview brief. Is the overview beneficial to the board?
How many slides do you have?
I have 33.
I don't want to go through 33 slides.
Okay. So let's just touch maybe on, I believe, just the frequently asked questions. These are the questions we get the most.
Hey, Stacy.
Yes.
Can I suggest, I think it would be worthwhile to at least touch on the state's regulatory requirements.
Sure.
And those and how we meet those, and then step into the frequently asked questions. I think those are the most relevant slides.
Okay. So the Utah Division of Drinking Water has required a cross-connection control program since 1987. So it's not new. It's been around a long time. They are just now penalizing water companies that are not following the rules. So
can you define what, if you go back to the first slide, define what cross-connection control is.
So a cross-connection control program is required from the Division of Drinking Water, and there are five different elements. Let me get to the elements. This is what the state will look for in our sanitary survey every 3 years when they come and evaluate our system. These are the five elements that they look to see that we are enforcing. So public awareness, trained staff, record keeping, and ongoing enforcement. We already have the policy in place. It's part of our rules and regs. It's in section 7 of our rules and regs. So let me go back to, So who's involved in a cross-connection control program? It starts at the federal level. That would be the EPA. Then it goes down to the state level, which is the Division of Drinking Water. Then it comes to us, the water purveyors, and the plumbing inspectors. That would be Summit County. So there's a lot of different people involved. And then it comes down to the consumer that has the backflow assembly installed on their property.
Right. Some of it's the building permit process. And
correct.
Building official.
So, Stacy, we're talking about a closed system here between the water district and the customers, not between, say, Summit Water and other in Park City. Not that kind.
I guess I'm not quite sure what your question was.
I can take that, Stacy. That's correct,
sure.
Tim. What we're talking about here is, the coupling essentially of a contamination source of one of our customers. So whether that be, their system, an irrigation system, a fire suppression system, or a commercial system that, a commercial customer that Mountain Regional serves. So a direct connection to one of our customers that backfeeds a contamination or a contaminant into our system. Is that helpful?
Yeah.
Okay,
so this will go through the five elements and then the sanitary survey. And these are the different types of backflow assemblies. We hit on the irrigation assemblies. These are just the rules since 1960. They've been required to be installed and tested. Licensed plumbers are required to install these backflow assemblies. And then prior to 2006, double check assemblies were acceptable and installed underground. And then plumbing code changed in 2006. And now they are required to have an RP assembly, and those are installed above ground. So of course, those are easier to see if the customer has those or not. And then of course, they're on their fire suppression systems. We have these on a lot of the homes in the district. More than half of our customer base has fire suppression systems, and
Understand RP, reduced principal.
Yes, that's rated for a health hazard. That's why it's required to be installed on an irrigation system.
No, the term reduced principal doesn't have an intuitive understanding.
Stacy, can you explain the function of an RP and how they work?
Sure, absolutely. So let me go back to, this This is an RP. So this is our main, goes in. This is what the customer is required to put in. Then this goes into their home. There's check valves in here, so nothing is allowed back into the system. It will dump out of this port right here. If anything goes back in, it will only allow the water to go one way. That's why it's rated health hazard, so nothing can get back into the drinking water system. That's just a type of backflow.
Did I clear it up, Tim?
Well, I've got a bad connection, I think, here. Is that what I was asking for is, I understand what a backflow preventer is, okay? I don't understand the term reduced principle.
It's just the mechanics of the backflow itself. So there's double checks. Those have two checks in. The reduced pressure is where the pressure drops out and it drains out the port. It's just a different type of a backflow.
Okay.
So let me get back to down towards the bottom. And then we have domestic backflows. We require these on all our commercial accounts. When we do hazard assessments on the commercial accounts, they're one of the highest hazards on our system. So we require it to be on all of our connections for commercial and industrial. This means that nothing gets back into our drinking water. That doesn't protect what's inside the building. Hopefully they're up to code on all their plumbing inside, but we just have this on our side to protect our customers.
Right, and that's the equipment. And then are they required to have that inspected by a licensed plumber every year and then provide that inspection to us?
Yes, correct. They hire a backflow technician that's certified with the state to test that annually, and then they submit the report.
And that's where it kind of gets to be ticklish if we don't always get those reports or if they don't know they're supposed to do that. And that's one of the hard parts of it, I think.
Yeah, that is the hard part. Plumbing code makes that customer put it in, and then the state makes us require that test because they're on our drinking water system. So it's kind of hard. We kind of play the middle guy.
Yeah.
And so, go ahead.
How many of those tests, required tests, percentage-wise, do you think we get annually?
We did pretty good in 2019. Last year was pretty hard with COVID. A lot of extensions were given out because people didn't want them in their home. So we gave them an extension until this year to get those tested. We're pretty close to 100%, though, the prior years for getting those tests in.
Stacy does a great job of, bird dogging these customers. She sends multiple notices. With respect to the ones that are in our inventory, Stacy, like you said, we're nearly 100% in 2019. 2020, a little different because of COVID.
Correct.
The tough one to tackle.
It is. So I know our system's a little bit unique to other systems in the area because of the new residential developments like Promontory, Colony, Glenwell, Preserve, Stagecoach, Red Hawk, and New Park. They were all required to install those fire suppression systems and irrigation systems a part of their development agreement. So we knew they had to have them in, so that's why we put them in our inventory, and they've been receiving notices since they were installed. It's a little bit different when you think of Summit Water and Gargoza. We have a lot of new development compared to the other water systems. We're kind of unique in that way.
What about some of the new developments, like Silver Creek Village? Is that part of, I'm sorry, I don't necessarily know, but is that part of Mountain Regional Water?
Yes, it is. And we have inventory of all the new builds that have had a final inspection, and all of those have been recorded in our inventory.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah, Joel, the any new customer that comes in, if they have a need for a backflow prevention device, they are made aware of that, and that device becomes part of our program.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you.
So then the grandfather connections are also required, aren't they, to have to comply with this program?
Yes, I'm going to get to that slide. So when you're talking about the grandfather ones, a lot of this pertains to like the irrigation backflows. If you change anything on an irrigation system, say you change the sprinkler head or you change a valve, plumbing code requires you to bring that to code and install a backflow, well, the RP, like we talked about, that's what is required now for plumbing code on an irrigation system. So if somebody changes anything on their irrigation system, they're supposed to put that in. A lot of our customers don't know that. We're in the process of implementing a program and compelling ideas together to discover those and to get the information out to our customers that that's required.
Stacy, can you?
What about when we, if we acquire another water company, is this part of the due diligence?
It is.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Stacy, can you touch on the correspondence you had with the Division of Drinking Water this week?
Yeah, I spoke to Gary, and he said through all his experience that education was the best policy to start out with to educate the customers first before requiring it, just so they kind of know what's going on. We asked for some ideas to expand our program, and we're kind of like one of the first programs to start doing this. So we're trying to get all the ideas together so we can educate our customers.
My takeaway and my understanding is that it's customary for all new, you know, all new builds, all new customers to be part of a cross connection control program. As far as going back and auditing existing customers and homes that may have been built prior to some of these regulations, that is forging new ground. The division called Mountain Regional pioneers in this area. Their recommendation was to start with public education and public awareness, and to work from that into more formal enforcement programs.
Yes.
Would part of that public awareness, would it be fair to just highlight the benefits of getting a backflow preventer for people that are grandfathered? I mean, I know the home that I live in does not have one, but anytime we have a break in Summit Park, which seems to happen regularly, it definitely puts a lot of pressure on our water softener, the siphoning. And so, yeah, I mean, is that something you would recommend to smaller homes that are grandfathered, that maybe they should consider getting a backflow?
Yes, because every pressurized irrigation system in the state of Utah is required to have one of those. But until you change anything on your system, you don't have to install it unless you want to install it just to protect yourself and your neighbors.
Okay, so maybe I had that wrong. What if you don't have pressurized irrigation?
Then you don't need one. You would just have the hose bib connectors on the outside of your home. Those drain, that's an actual backflow device that are required on the taps on the outside of your home. That protects you.
And maybe to touch on, I think where Ian's going, or his question is related. Ian, on your meter, essentially in your meter setter and your meter pit, you should have check valves on that. And if you get the sense that they may not be functioning properly, we can get out there and take a look.
Mine aren't. There's no way. Yeah, I definitely siphon into the house, because I now work from home. So I know the last three breaks, it's definitely siphoned into the house.
Okay. We can. Hey, Brian, or I guess it would be, yeah, either Brian or Anna, I guess. Let's make sure that John O'Brien or somebody from operations takes a look at that.
So typically, wouldn't it siphon into the house anyways? It's just the water would siphon out of the house, but then when it gets to the meter, it'll drain out at the pressurized connector, the backflow preventer in the meter. Or shouldn't it siphon into the house if the meter has the backflow?
It should not siphon out. I do know that a lot of homes in Summit Park, especially older ones, there is not a check valve on the meter setter itself. I know my house didn't have one until we did the upgrade last year.
Okay.
But I would think with the change-out program that Ian should have been upgraded as well, which I guess is my point. Let's make sure it was.
Yeah. That's true.
I'd be interested. Brian, let me know. I'd be really interested. If it is working properly, then I might need to talk to somebody then. Okay, thanks.
Yep. We'll double-check it.
Do we have a list of approved plumbers that we recommend, or is that a no-no?
Yeah, we don't send that out. We send them the link to the state, to their testing list, anybody that has that qualification. We don't like to recommend anybody, so nothing falls back on the district.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Stacy, on a building inspection on a real estate transaction, is this something that the building, that the whoever's taking a look at assessing the house, is this something that in this county they have to cite during a real estate transaction?
You know, I'm not sure on that. I know when the title company calls us for final assessments, we let them know if the backflow had been tested for the year. I'm not sure as far as the real estate thing, if that is required or not.
Let me try to answer your question. If there's any material that the realtor needs to disclose that, no matter which side, whether it's buyer or seller. So they have a response. The realtor has a responsibility to ask that question and to give any type of documentation that's needed.
So, Stacy, do you want to step through the frequently asked questions?
Yes.
Well, there's just one more group that there's probably some backflow preventers out there that homeowners don't even know they have.
That's correct. There are probably a lot more than we know, especially because back before 2006, you were able to install those below ground, like in irrigation boxes. So I'm sure customers have no idea what that is. That would be part of our, you know, educational process to our customers in identifying those and what needs to be done if they change anything.
This is Joel. Do we have any exposure? Does Mountain Regional have any exposure if we don't do our job? And this may be more directed to Dave Thomas than anyone. Maybe Scott knows, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, we have, I think, exposure in two areas, Joel. One is with respect to the Division of Drinking Water. If our program was not deemed to be compliant, they would assess essentially demerit points, right? They have a point system. Those points could lead to the district becoming a not approved system. We currently are in full compliance with the Division of Drinking Water. Over the years, they have commended Stacy and the district with having one of the best programs in the state. So from a compliance perspective with the division, we're fine. From a legal liability perspective, I could envision that we may have some if somebody, had... Oh, I don't know, a hose and a bucket of antifreeze, and somehow that got into the system and somebody got sick. You know, I'll let Dave take that, but, I'll let Dave take that.
Generally latent defects or problems that we don't know of in the system, we have governmental immunity on. But if something comes up that's affecting the overall system and we have knowledge of it, and we're negligent in not going out and trying to fix it, trying to remedy it, yeah, we could have some liability.
I'm just trying to limit our exposure, obviously. we have quite a number of expenses, and the last thing we need is to be sued.
Yeah.
Hopefully that makes sense.
Absolutely. And that's
can you give me acute knowledge or of a situation or general knowledge?
Of what?
If we know that the system.
We have to have specific knowledge of a specific defect, and we don't do anything about it. If it is you get into this situation where they talk about discretionary action, the courts, where you've got maybe you've got a problem in the system, but it's not an acute problem, and it's something that you're going to take care of over time, but you don't have the money for it now. You make a discretionary decision that you're not going to fix it at the present time, and the court will say that you're immune from suit for that. So, for example, not a water example, but a public works example, you've got part of a roadway that's on a curve with a big fall off, and you have to decide whether you're going to put up a guardrail or not. It's a discretionary decision. I mean, you decide you're not going to put up the guardrail and someone goes off. They could sue you, but you would have immunity. It really is those circumstances where there's an acute defect in the system and a reasonable person would fix it, and we, for whatever reason, are negligent. Yeah, that's where the exposure comes in.
So I guess, specifically, every hose bib in the system is supposed to have a vacuum breaker on it, right?
Yes.
So should we go out and inspect all of those and put vacuum breakers on them?
I mean, this is one of the questions that I presented to our internal group, our staff, during a meeting is our job to enforce plumbing code? Is our job to go on everybody's property and look for vacuum breakers on every hose bib and look for pressurized irrigation systems that may or may not have backflow devices on them?
I think that's the question.
And I think the answer is no. You don't have that responsibility. It only comes up if you are put on notice of something and it could affect a system-wide or a large portion of the system, and as a result, you don't do anything.
So
that's where it would come in.
Yeah. So the way that we have handled existing systems, and I think we're following right in line with Dave's recommendation here, is that if we physically see a backflow prevention device that is not part of our inventory, that device is then added to our inventory.
Dave, where do we stand with regards to having an implementation plan and whether we're found to be following the implementation plan or the corrective action plan?
I mean, it becomes very fact specific. You have to evaluate if there's an acute defect in the system. You have to evaluate what it's going to affect, and you just have to take reasonable action.
Are we saying hose bibs are not an acute defect?
It's probably not an acute defect. I mean, is as a result of that, is that going to result in having levels of, something in the water that violates the Clean Water Act? Is it something that's going to cause individuals to become sick? I mean, it's It's one thing if you have, E. coli in the water at a source and you're on notice of that. Once you're on notice of that, yeah, that's a significant thing and you've got to do something about it. And whether that is, we're treating it with chlorine, okay. But as long as you're dealing with it in a reasonable manner, you're not going to be liable for injuries.
And I guess how we're going to deal with the hose bibs is through education. And that's reasonable.
Yeah, so, my comments on where do we go from here with respect to, Stacey, if you wouldn't mind going to the previous slide. How do we identify non-compliant systems? Like I said, if we physically get our eyes on a backflow prevention device at somebody's home that's not in our system, we add it. With respect to a broad, audit, if you will, or a broad view of the district of all those that may have backflow prevention devices that are not part of our system. The recommendation from the state, we agree internally that we should start with an education program, and Ian hit the nail on the head earlier with, I think that education program should be, about the benefit of backflow prevention devices and how it protects not only our customers, but their neighbors around them, and the greater system as a whole. So, the first step that we've identified is that public awareness program, Mike. And then we also are looking internally at opportunities, where other opportunities to locate these devices and get them into our inventory. A third step in the future, after we've made sure that we're getting that educational material out, a third step would be potentially a more broad audit of water use versus where these devices are in our inventory. But I think the idea here is to make sure that we're getting that educational material out before we move into a stronger enforcement program.
Scott, is our education program centered more around the billing? Do we send out flyers with letters? Because it seems to me that the opportunity for education has been changing as quickly as newspapers have been going under and no one watches TV anymore. I mean, how are we doing that? How are we keeping up to speed with what an effective education process is?
As far as keeping up to speed, we attend, through these conferences, virtual conferences this year, there's been quite a bit of talk about public outreach and how we better connect with our customers. That's something that Lisa's been attending a number of these discussions. And then as far as what are we specifically doing, this is going to be part of a push for us here in the spring. We're identifying what those specific actions are. Whether it's, I think, it's something in the mail. People don't read their mail. Door hangers seem to be effective. We do have, social media programs, but I don't think we have enough followers at this point to really gain much traction there. I think the radio is another opportunity, whether it be recorded messaging or also interviews. We could potentially, I think this dovetails nicely with conservation messaging as we're staring at pretty significant drought in the face this year. So those are some of the ideas that we've been talking about.
It's a couple of points. Should not necessarily in any particular order, but should we be partnering with anyone to get any word out on this issue? That's number one. Number two, do we have a list of proposed backflow issues that that we know are good and people gravitate to more. I guess another way to put it is, are there any backflow systems that we wouldn't honor as far as they're no good, or they've got problems, or they've been recalled, or what have you? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, Joel. I think with respect to specific devices and things, my assumption, Stacy, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but that would defer back to plumbing code and what devices are allowed and not allowed. And I would think that plumbers and plumbing code would handle sort of recalls and things like that. With respect to partnering, I think that there are opportunities, but it's a bit of a hot potato, to be honest with you. You know, the partnership opportunities are with the other water providers in Park City. And if those providers have a program that either is not as far along as ours, or if they have sort of different policies on how they want to address their program, then that becomes prohibitive. That doesn't mean that I can't reach out, and I'd be happy to do that, to reach out with some of the other water providers and ask them what their programs are.
Yeah, I'm just asking the question. Again, this all has to do with what I consider to be exposure.
Yeah.
We just don't want it. We don't need the litigation. Jesus, Jenny.
Yeah. So we've kind of touched generally on just some questions that the board has. Do we want, we haven't really gotten into Stacy's Q&A slides. Do we want to step through those, or do we feel like we've answered questions and the board's had a chance to review the packet materials?
I went through all the slides already.
I think it's been a really good presentation, Stacy, and thank you for letting us kind of take it apart and make it probably harder.
Stacy, you had no idea, did you?
No, thank you.
Always fun. So I don't know, maybe give us just a summary, a conclusion of where we're headed next.
Let me go down. I just think it's just part of the water quality we send to our customers. It's just a prevention program that we're trying to protect that so carefully treated water that we send to our customers. We're just trying to keep it safe. That's my whole goal.
Awesome. And I think as we look forward, Mike, I think it's trying to get our arms around, these existing systems, that again, the state basically said we're pioneers to start forging into this territory.
Yeah, it's tricky. How do we comply with this mandate from the state? It's got some challenges that comes with it that they really put on us.
Yeah. I want to thank Stacy. Like I said, she is highly regarded at the state level for all the work she's done for the program. So I think we have had a great start, and we'll continue to try to improve. It's not perfect, I think we need to we recognize there's some improvements that we want to make, and we're trying to figure out how to best do that.
Let's not forget the award that she won last year.
Operator of the year.
Doing this.
Thank you.
Thanks, Stacy.
Thanks, Stacy.
All right, Mike, we ready to move on to Steve's section here?
Yeah, item 6. Mr. Steve Anderson on the financial components. Steve, you might be on mute.
Yeah, Steve, we can't hear you. I'm sure it sounded great, though.
They looked great when I reviewed them all, so.
Yeah, those are impressive year-end numbers. So,
still can't hear you, Steve.
Especially the volume.
Weird, we had you at the beginning. Should we move on? And Steve, do you want to log out and log back in and see if you can't see if that doesn't fix it? We can circle back to Steve.
I think that makes sense, yeah. So then we'd be on item 7, the general manager comments.
Yep, thanks, Mike. So we had our leadership meeting last week with members of the council, Chris Robinson and Glenn Wright. Mike Kobe and Ian Schofield attended, as well as Tom Fisher and Dave Thomas. These are leadership meetings, Joel, just so you know that, they're sort of, we try to have them quarterly. The reality is if we get two or three in a year, that's good. But anyway, it's an opportunity to get together as a group and just talk about some of the ongoing issues and to make the county leadership aware of challenges that may be ahead. So the first issue that we talked about was, as the board is aware, I've mentioned this in the past, the Pine Meadows Mutual Water Company has experienced a decline in their groundwater production. We have an emergency interconnect with Pine Meadows. Starting last summer in 2020, we did need to provide them sort of ongoing water to support the demands of their system. So Pine Meadows certainly recognizes this. They had reached out to me and to Mountain Regional requesting, essentially a perpetual source of supply, to support their system. And, you know, the long story short is that that's not allowed per Mountain Regional's rules and regs because we can only provide water outside of our system so long as there's surplus available. And at some point, Mountain Regional is going to need to do source development. And by definition, that source is going to be needed for our own customers. It's also not supported by the Constitutional Amendment D, which was voted on for those who voted in the December election. And So where do we go from here? So what I did is I presented two options to the council, same options that I presented to Pine Meadows in early December. Those two options are, one, to annex into Mountain Regional's district, which is the customary approach in this situation. The second possibility that I thought through and discussed internally was we could potentially purchase water through the master agreement. And Joel, you'll have to bear with us here. I'll bring you up to speed on this, but this is the regional agreement between Park City, Mountain Regional, Summit Water, and Weaver Basin. We could purchase water through the master agreement and effectively wheel it to Pine Meadows. The county council's position was not a big surprise. Their recommendation was to follow the tried and true approach of annexation. They were concerned about, a new precedence being set, and that may cause issues as other growth or expansions happen. You know, Browns Canyon comes to mind. Maybe there's a developer that wants to just purchase water and run their own system, and the county sort of ends up back in the challenge they were in when Mountain Regional was formed, with a number of small water systems and challenges with those. They felt as though that an annexation also provided a more complete protection for a deficient water system. It was not a belt and suspenders sort of approach to get them by. So you know, from my perspective, we have a memorandum of understanding that was signed in 2014 with Pine Meadows. There's a structure for Pine Meadows to be able to pay for water that Mountain Regional provides to them in accordance with our wholesale rate on our rate sheet. And I am comfortable continuing with that approach so long as we have surplus water, in our system. And I would couple that directly with the surplus schedule in the master agreement. As soon as that surplus in the master agreement goes away, I think that is really the point at which annexation would need to occur. I think we're probably six to 10 years out from that need. But as we all know, annexations are challenging. They require a ton of planning. And so I will, you know, extend to Pine Meadows this information and, you know, provide them an opportunity to start thinking through this and us working together on what that might look like.
Scott, with annexation, we have, I mean, they become part of our system, and we have an affirmative obligation to provide water to them, right, as opposed to some agreement where we're providing water other than annexation. Doesn't it? I mean, I guess the main question I have is, what's our ability to actually provide the water to them under an annexation? I mean, are they going to – what are their current rates up there at Pine Meadows?
You mean the price of water, the you know, water rates to their customers? Lost you there, Tim. I'll just assume that was your – I think that was your question. I believe their rates are higher than ours. I don't know that for sure, but I believe that to be the case. They do not allow outdoor watering up there, so the price per thousand under their current structure is potentially higher than ours.
Okay. But they're at about, what, 8,000 feet?
Yeah, I don't know their exact elevation, but they're up there.
Yeah. So we take whatever our base rate is and then put elevation on the top of it.
Yeah, so our what we're charging them currently, Tim, per the MOU is our wholesale rate, which is $13.39 per thousand plus the HEPS, which is another, what was it, Steve, 286?
286 per thousand.
Yep, so you're up to what is it, 13.3 roughly? You're at 16 or so per thousand. And they took, you know, they took about 3 million gallons this summer.
That goes on an emergency basis. It doesn't, they can't really count that to their concurrency, can they?
No, they can. I'm not in the mix with their regulatory paperwork or requirements that they have or mandates from the Division of Drinking Water. With respect to Summit County, they're not part of the concurrency program. Because the concurrency program focused on the Snoderville Basin and the Park City area, and they're outside of that. So as concurrency extends to the east side of the county, they would be included in that.
Do we know where the council stands on this?
Well, I mean, we met with council members last week, and their position was that they should annex.
Do we know the county's time frame for moving concurrency?
Oh, the concurrency. It was on Rich Bullough's work plan for 2020, and then COVID hit. So the health department administers the concurrency program. I think Rich is hopeful that 2021, he was hopeful that 2021 they would start to push that out, but I have a feeling that's going to be pushed back even further.
But this isn't the reason why they approached you, because like you just said, the water, if we wheeled them water, that would not count towards concurrency. So at that point, they're kind of in a hard spot.
I think that it would, Ian. I think that what they could do is they could, my recommendation to council, if we took that approach, was that they did in fact enter the concurrency program, because I would think council would require that. And then in the concurrency worksheets, there is an area for, you know, wholesale water that is purchased. So that would count, and that would show. From a state regulatory perspective, I'm not sure how that's handled.
If it really counts if it's only on the table for 5 years.
Yeah, if it's temporary, then it would not meet I wouldn't think it would meet the state's requirements.
All right, that's the piece I missed. Okay, so your proposal to council would have counted toward concurrency. Our current agreement with them does not.
Our current agreement, that's a good question, Ian.
Because it's just year to year, right? I mean, it's not a long-standing.
I mean, it's the way that it's structured, I don't believe it would count towards concurrency. It's really not structured as a wholesale purchase agreement. The agreement was related to the interconnection of the two systems, and in the event Pine Meadows needed water, a rate at which they had to pay for it.
The reason I was asking is potentially that moves up that time frame when we would need to annex them, right? If concurrency is applied on them and our current contract does not apply, then they're in a hard spot.
That's correct.
But Scott, are they out of options?
Yes, they are out of options, Tim. That's a good point. I did not touch on that. They have tried to develop source. Ian can talk more to this. Groundwater options don't exist up there. I looked at in-stream flow numbers in Silver Creek, which is at the base of Tollgate Canyon Road at the bottom of their development, and there's no water in that creek in the summer. We're talking, you know, less than a CFS, so you can't, they're not, you know, a surface water treatment plant is not an option. Mountain Regional is their only option.
So they're out of options. They're in Summit County. You go beyond this, if we don't act in a timely manner, this could become a public relations disaster, right?
In what way? What are you thinking about, Tim?
A bunch of homes up there without water.
Well, I think they've got a backstop with us for the time being. Like I said, up until the point that we're not comfortable providing them water, and we'll be transparent about what that deadline is. You know,
are we comfortable providing anybody with water?
Well,
yeah, we are.
at the amount of water that they need, it is not a concern of me from a source capacity standpoint. So, I'm as comfortable providing them water as I am our customers, which, as we all know, is intermittent depending upon any emergencies we face.
It's about 800 lots at build out. They may have 200 to 400 currently in there. So it could, if they annexed in, it could really, make those lots, more viable.
Yep. That's correct. And there's some, as you know, Mike, there's some people that want that and there's others who don't, you know, so I think it's, that's their challenge they'll have to work through when that time comes, because they're going to need the majority of the votes to go through the annexation.
Do they have storage up there right now?
They do, Tim. They've got two tanks.
Okay.
They've got a fairly new system. The system was built about 15 years ago, so it's a fairly new system. It's up to current standards. I think it's a far better system than, outside of source deficiency, it's a far better distribution system than certainly community water was.
Who owns the storage?
Hey, Scott,
yeah.
About how many months they have left before they run out of water or the water turns bad?
You know, Joel, they have us as a backstop now. So, you know, even if they continue to have declines in their source production, so long as we're able to provide them with surplus. And like I said, I think we're, you know, we've got surplus on our master agreement schedule 5 years out. So we're, you know, we're 6+ years out before there's, an imminent situation that must be addressed.
And one thing, Joel, that, note is that we didn't start giving them water in any significant quantity until partway through the summer, and we're not anymore. It's just sort of a seasonal thing where we were making up their shortage, and we're not currently giving them water.
Okay, thank you.
But if it's an annual freshet kind of timed recharge, and unfortunately, this winter does not look like it's going to be above average. We're doing quite poorly right now on snowpack. that they could be in the same struggles they had this last summer, if not more. And, you know, to the question Tim asked earlier, do they have any other options? It's a tertiary conglomerate to volcanic set of materials up there. They're extremely tight. They don't make water. They have no options.
Wow. Wow.
And that's potentially tied to why they are having problems right now. Depending on how the well was put in and assessed initially, they've potentially been partially mining water from the formation all these years, and now they've gotten to a point where they've hit the sustainable yield, and they're beyond that. So they're probably in trouble the next couple of years.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Any further questions before we move on? I don't want to extend us too long here.
I guess just the scale of it is, if there were 400 units and we served each a half an acre foot because mm-hmm. there was no outdoor, that would be 200 acre feet. And you know, that does fit in with our surplus, right? What were we trying to, what was that mark on the curve where we were?
On the water right side, which is what you're touching on, Mike, I'm trying to keep 500.
So it'd be 40% of that.
Yeah, so I mean, we have more than that now, and I've got some, but anyway, you're right. I don't think that those customers would use that much water. Our current customers use about 4 tenths, but in any event, if you, it's a number of customers, is I think your point, Mike, and it does have an impact.
Yeah.
Is this all of Pinebrook or just parts of Pinebrook?
So it's Pine Meadows, Joel, just to be clear.
Pine Meadows, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
So it would be their system, like Mike said, I think, and Chris, maybe you could dive in here. I think it's roughly 800 lots or so, and they're, I think, maybe, 25% to 50 at the most percent built out.
Yeah, and it's Pine Meadows and Forest Meadows as far as the actual subdivisions go. Yeah. It's all the stuff that's the two large plats that are up Tollgate Canyon.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So the other conversations we had with council, we touched on drought conditions. Summit County is in varying levels of drought. If you look at the U.S. Drought Monitor, from moderate to exceptional drought. As you'll recall, for the board members that have seen it, Weber Basin has a drought contingency plan. That plan has essentially demand reduction targets based on drought levels that they have within their plan. Tage presented a couple weeks ago that from Weber Basin basically said that he didn't expect to see any demand reductions done on municipal and industrial water for 2021 because the reservoirs were full at the end of the spring last year. Last year they used essentially a year's worth of water, so we got basically no rain in the spring, in the summer. They've got a year left. So Tage's point is, I think that municipal and industrial is in good shape. My concern is more what are we looking at next year if we have another tough year? The council's position or thoughts were that M&I water is at the top of the food chain, and I would agree. But also I think if there's no water in the reservoirs, they're going to have to cut municipal and industrial water. They've never had to do it before, but I think as we look to the future, that will likely happen at some point. So I just mentioned the council, we will work on essentially a response or mitigation framework internally, including some financial modeling to try to understand how we would overcome those demand reductions at the various levels in Weber Basin's plan. The Weber Basin board votes in March on demand reductions for each year. So we'll be watching closely their vote in March, and we'll have dialogue with Weber Basin following that if we see any reductions placed on Mountain Regional. Important to note for Joel, and to remind the board, we purchase about 80% of our water from Weber Basin. So if there are demand reductions placed on their customers, we would fall into that, and we would have to respond accordingly. And the risk there, obviously, is revenue generation for water sales.
All right, if we come up with this drought rate, But, you know, one thing I've wondered about since we spoke with them, Scott, was how do they balance water rights and those senior rights with curtailing deliveries? Is that blended into their plan?
I think, yes, I think it is, Mike. But I don't know how to specifically answer that question, but I do think they account for it. Lastly, we just talked about district goals and key efforts for 2021. We're going to meet internally as staff and put together those key bullets. We'll get that out to the board in the February packet, just so you understand what our focus points are, internally for 2021. Ian or Mike, do you have any comments about that meeting or, any color to add beyond what I mentioned?
I've been kind of putting my head as we went, so Ian, why don't you go?
I was actually surprised how strong the opinions from Glenn and Chris were on going to annexation, so it kind of made part of the conversation a little bit easier. Scott, did you think Chris wanted us to actually perform that exercise he suggested, doing a kind of a mass balance on what it would cost them to wheel the water versus annexation cost-wise to see which one was benefit? I think his opinion was made up, but it seemed like he was kind of playing it out in his head while we were chatting.
I think we owe ourselves and the council a review of kind of what those finances start to look like, at least from a high level. And that's something that's on my to-do list. You know, there's elements in that MOU that was signed back in 2014 that adjust some of these financial numbers as well.
Right. Glenn was really interested about our next visit. He wanted to know about the water rights and return flows.
Yep.
And how the efficiency projects impact the return flows.
Yeah, Glenn. Glenn's anxious to promote conservation across the county, whether through ordinance or other ways. And you're right, Mike, he's concerned about return flows. Weber Basin turned him on to that, and he wants to make sure that we're looking at it holistically. If there's no further comments, I'll move on to other. I've got a couple things here. Summit Water did have a water quality incident on a shared source that we have with them. It is on the Silver Creek Spring. Thankfully, we disinfect that water prior to it entering into our distribution system. But they did have an E. coli positive. And we found out the test was pulled on Friday, I believe. We found out on Sunday that the tests were positive. You know, again, this is on source water that we then disinfect with chlorine. So we our follow-up testing was both on the source water as well as distribution system samples, as well as tank, you know, our tank samples from the tank that provides the water to that distribution system. All of our samples came up clean. We did not detect E. coli on any of those samples. All of the distribution samples, due to the level of chlorine that we carry and its effectiveness at disinfecting E. coli and other bacteria, was clean. So with respect to our customers in Silver Springs and in Sun Peak and the Olympic Park, they had safe drinking water throughout this incident. What this means is a couple things. One is E. coli presence in groundwater typically means that groundwater is under the influence of surface water. So SAM is working directly with the state, and Summit Water certainly is as well, on, you know, kind of where we go from here. Is it determined to be under the influence of surface water now, or does it require additional E. coli positives in the future to make that ultimate determination? If it is determined to be under the influence of surface water, that would mean additional treatment would be necessary on that source before we could provide that water to our customers. The other thing that it means in the very near term is that we have to notice all customers served by that source, that there was an E. coli positive sample taken on our source water. Sam and I and others internally today have been working on the language of that notice. That notice is going to go out tomorrow, is our expectation, so long as we get the final okay from the division. And it basically says that, you know, again, there was a detection in the source water. That source water is disinfected. That disinfection was effective so that the drinking water was safe during the incident. But we do have an obligation to notice those customers.
Is part of the back analysis that Sam's doing looking at the delineated capture zone for the spring and seeing if any potential contamination sources have changed in there?
I mean, we know what that is, Ian. It includes a lot of development in the canyons area. And we've been concerned about development influencing that spring for years.
Leaks in sewer lines, or like what's the PCS that's contributing to E. coli?
That's a good question. I would venture to say it's not necessarily sewer lines, but more excavations that are providing a direct path from surface to that groundwater source. Does that make sense?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, with all that development, yeah, you've probably made a whole beehive of them.
Let me just make a comment on the canyons. I mean, there's a lot of development that's still to come. That may affect planning. That may affect the long-term relationship of the canyons. But there's a lot of development that's going to happen there.
Yep.
We have about 1 million square feet.
Yeah, thanks for that, Joel. And so, yeah, this isn't a big surprise to me. You know, certainly we didn't, you know, when I say surprise, I mean generally with the development that we've seen, we were hoping this day didn't come. We'll see what the state requires or determines. I think it's highly likely that we'll be having future discussions about expenditures that are needed to be able to treat that water. The spring's a valuable source to us. It's something that we would certainly want to put some treatment on, and Summit Water will as well. It's turned out, Mike. As soon as we found out, we stopped using that source. So that's just, you know, running into the creek. So, you know, we've done, I'm really happy with the response of the district and the distribution team. I think we did everything appropriately, and I think that, we're doing everything we can. At this point, it's, just working with the state on where we go from here.
How many acre feet does it make annually?
I don't have the number in front of me. I would bet it's on the order. We utilize on the order of 300 is my bet. I think we probably have twice that with respect to rights allocated to that source. But, you know, we use it as much as we can. There's periods in the spring during runoff where the turbidity is too high. There's, you know, we're using it as much as we can. And I could send you the exact numbers, but I think on the order of 300 in 2020.
Summit uses the same.
Summit has a greater allocation in the summer, so they likely use more. It's a more important source to them than it is to us, but it is important to both of us.
So just in numbers, it was in 2019, it was 260 acre feet, and in 2020, it was 309 acre feet out of the spring.
All right, I'm off by 9. You can get the ruler out.
Well, yeah, slap your hand, Scott.
Good guessing.
Yeah. Sam, do you want to make any comments?
I don't really have anything to add at this point. I mean, but it's evolving, and if I had to make a prediction on the way things were headed, it's likely some additional treatment steps that are going to happen at this location, both for Summit Water and ourselves.
They're comfortable with the collection box that's there right now. I've never been to that site. I don't know what's there, but they don't think it's an issue with the collection.
I think Brian could chime in. They've more recently renovated their collection system, the Mount Regional, if I'm correct there.
Yeah, they redid the whole collection system back in the late 90s. And it's been suspect over the years, you know, with the gravel pack and stuff that they put in there. We've had some contamination issues, you know, due to that. But I think the collection box itself is pretty tight. But I don't know about, you know, the gravel pack and everything that comes out of the mountain. I think it's tight. So, like mentioned earlier, I think all the contamination is coming from the canyon's development and the golf course and that kind of stuff.
And this has been, you know, this was... Go ahead, Joel.
No. I wasn't going to say anything.
Okay.
I do have a comment, though, later on.
Okay. You know what? You know, to be honest, this source was part of the source protection ordinance that the Summit County Health Department ultimately had passed. You know, we, Summit Water and Mountain Regional, had concerns about development impacting this source. And part of the provisions in that source protection ordinance are for new developments to, for that to be reviewed by the water provider. So this was an element in those discussions. So any further questions on that?
So will we have a seat at the table with the upcoming development within the canyons, or that's already approved?
It depends if it's already been approved, but there is a service provider review process for new development, and we know if that falls within the source protection zone or not, and the use of that, you know, is that use a concern to the water district? We have the ability to comment on that.
So we might want to comment in the future.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge is as you know, Ian, you know, general excavations are not a PCS, right? So, you know, PCS for the group is a potential contamination source. You know, if it were like a cattle operation or something like that, you know, that's a red flag. But a hotel, not typically.
Yeah.
So last topic, or second to last, I have is I was approached by Steve Clyde. For those who know, Steve's a prominent water right attorney in Utah. He has a customer who's a landowner on Old Ranch Road who has interest in trying to provide snowmaking water to the canyons portion of Park City Mountain. They have been trying to solve snowmaking water supply challenges for years, and essentially the ask from Steve Clyde from his client is, can his client drill a well and have Mountain Regional essentially operate and maintain it, and then lease capacity in our system to move that water to the canyons? We're in very initial discussions on that. Generally, I'm not a big fan. I need to think through this a little bit more. One positive or one advantage that may come to the district as part of it is that we would be able to utilize that source in the summer to provide water for our peak irrigation system or peak irrigation season, excuse me. And, you know, obviously it would generate some revenue for the district to be able to lease that capacity in the system during the winter, which is during an off-peak period where we have an abundance of capacity in that system at that time. I think from a district perspective, I want to make sure that we are not giving something up that in the future we want back. So that's kind of the position I'm in at the moment.
Scott, do you know where the well would be? Would it be kind of out there on that, like, Copper Moose farm property?
You got it, Tim. Across from Willow Creek, generally.
But in a not specific location, just anywhere out there?
Well, we don't have the specific point, you know, on the property, but it is that landowner that you're talking about.
Okay. It seems like it's complementary in some respects.
In some respects, you're right.
You get the water that would have to be dedicated to snowmaking, which is an economic benefit. And then in the summertime, there's no snowmaking needed. You might need the water. And if you could get it and sell it commercially for landscaping and whatnot.
maybe fill up that 2-acre pond just down the street with it.
Well, it would be drilled as a drinking water source, Tim, so it could feed, you know, we could provide that to our customers. Its location in our system is advantageous. We do not have any sources right there that water would head directly to the base of the colony. We've thought about drilling on Old Ranch Road for years.
It just seems complimentary to our program offhand.
Any further comment on that?
So I assume that he has the water rights and then he doesn't need it for his farming operations or whatever?
You got it, Karen. You know, the water, we would likely have to place our own water rights on it for use in the summer, but he would be using his own for the winter operation. Any other questions, concerns? The last thing I have is just board positions. I think January is typically when we vote on board positions. We did not have that on the agenda, so I will check on when we typically do that. And with Bob's departure and Joel coming on board, it's the right time, I think, to work through that. We need to identify a new vice chair since that position is vacant and work through our annual position review.
You know, that starts in March, Scott.
Oh, is that March, Lisa?
March, our annual meeting and election.
And that coincides, I guess, with Dave's training as well.
Yeah, usually we do that together.
Okay, thanks, Lisa. That's all I have. Steve, do you want to maybe really briefly kind of run through your topics? We're starting to get up against 8 o'clock here.
Yeah. Can everybody hear me okay now? Sorry about that.
You're good.
Don't know what happened there. I'll go through this real fast. So as most, I think a couple of you commented as I was getting off, the year ended really well, $1.8 million above budget, basically high revenue year, and we still were able to control our expenses and keep those below budget. The cash... we did have the significant drop in cash to $3.7 million, but as I mentioned, it was all planned expenditures for the Weaver Basin for water rights for next year and debt payments that come due in December, things like that. A couple of surprising things as we were going through this is the real estate market. December, we had 31 new connections, which is just crazy for a December to have that many new connections. Promontory also sold 20 lots in December. So they usually sell roughly 40 in a year, and they sold 20 in December. So they jumped from about 38 to 58 lots sold for the year. So there's going to be a lot of building going on next year, it looks like. Our water consumption was way up, as we knew, as with growth and with the hot, dry spring and summer. Our own customers up 26%. Golf took 15% more. Park City took about what they did last year, just a little bit less. And then, of course, Summit Water, this was their first year of the 1,100 acre feet. We collected a lot of receivables during December, so our outstanding receivables dropped. Park City caught up, basically paid for 2 months, and Promontory caught up on all the golf water from the summer. So our receivables ended the year in a really good position. Water sales, as you can see, that purple line trended well all year. We were above many historical sales we've had. And then this was just the snapshot of December revenue. A little bit above in residential, a little bit in wholesale, a little more snowmaking was going on since Mother Nature wasn't helping us out there. So glad to be able to report just good stuff for that. There was a memo in your packet about the insurance decision. Hopefully you had a chance to read that after the review from the attorneys. Doing our own kind of internal review, we just listed some of the reasons we decided to stay with Utah Local Governments Trust. Ironically, we've already had a no-fault incident that where a water line broke up in Summit Park and it washed away some of the dirt underneath the driveway and some landscaping and things like that, which we really aren't liable for because we can't predict a water line breaking because of it freezing. But the insurance said, hey, do you want to offer the $5,000 no fault to this customer? And I said yes. So it was great to not have to spend any time managing that or getting a crew out. It was just handled through the insurance. So,
and that was one of the benefits, Steve, that was one of the benefits that the government's trust offered that Olympus did not, correct?
Correct. That is something that the Olympus, their clients usually have to set up their own fund and manage it and things like that. And I think given the amount of these kind of small but very consequential to an individual customer type incident, it's a very nice piece of the policy with Utah local
Did
government.
Did Olympus understand that we're a water company when they put those clauses in their policy?
Yeah, I thought that was a little interesting. You know, even if they can explain it, you're like, that's still in writing somewhere. I'm going to have to jump through that hoop at some point about dams and canals and wells. That's all we have, you know, so... So yeah, it was a good process. Glad we went through it, but really glad with the decision we made as well, let's say. So, real quickly, we have retained the same attorneys, auditors for next year, Osborne, Robbins, and Bueller. They've been great to work with. We've got a good rhythm. They understand our system, our financials now. So look forward to working with them again for this, the audit of the 2020 year. So, that's in a nutshell or real quick all I had for tonight.
Steve, you're getting this down. That was great.
That's right.
Yeah, Steve, we had a lot of checks that went out for overcharges again this year. Is that something that, I mean, this last month, are the overcharges, are we seeing, is that arresting a little bit where we've got that under control? Because you didn't have anything in your financial report about how you were going to be addressing metering and overcharges.
Those refunds are really overcharges that come from titles. And we had about 120 homes change hands where we have to estimate the water bill and then refund. I'm sorry, Tim. I lost you.
I think he was touched on it. It was not a metering error in this case. These are refunds as a result of properties changing hands.
Yeah, and that many properties changing hand in 1 month is, again, ridiculous. We've never seen that before. But we have started to be able to refund through express bill pay, so that's a little quicker and less manpower hours on our end. And also, we're reviewing the title sheets a little more closely, trying to spend a little more time, do a little more work up front to save some time on the back end.
That sounds great, Steve. The one tidbit I was going to share with Mike Kobe is, Mike, we crossed 7,000 acre feet of production for the first time ever. So, including...
That's double. It's doubled in, what, 8 years?
Yeah, including Park City's delivery and Summit Water and everything else. It's broke 7,000. So, it's a big year. All right, Steve, anything else?
I think we've covered it. Everything okay. That needs to be covered. So.
All right, back to you, Mike. I think we're moving on to number 8.
Yes, and Mr. Dave Thomas on legal update.
I have nothing from my side.
No news is good news, huh?
That's right. Nobody sued you.
It's good news, Dave. Thank you.
Okay, on 9, do we have any questions on department updates? You want to go around the table? Start with Karen, maybe?
Yes, I had a couple of questions. So, Scott, you said that you had COVID hotline staffing, and I was just wondering if Mountain Regional had to provide the county people, or if that was something you were volunteering for, or
the county has requested assistance. So I threw my hat in that ring just so I could understand what that process looked like. Our understanding, Lisa and I are meeting with Jana Young tomorrow, who's the deputy county attorney. to understand how the FEMA reimbursement funds work, for money to come back to the district for the time that I spent and for the time that our employees may spend in the future. So, but that was the deal.
And then my second question was, for Lisa, like, it looks like we applied for some kind of grant to get paid back for COVID sick time. And I don't know, part of me wonders if, you know, with such a great year that we had, are we taking money out of maybe a poorer district's pocket by requesting those funds, or,
We didn't have a large dollar amount. We really only had two employees who qualified for the reimbursement. I had the paperwork filled out, and we talked about it before. It's part of the CARES Act funding. I think that they've put that out to everybody. So I applied for it.
Okay, those are my questions.
Two good ones. Okay, Ian, any questions on the updates?
Yeah, I've got a couple. Scott, real quick, any thoughts on Dave Warnock replacing Brian Bellamy? Are you foreseeing any shift in policy or anything we should be aware of with his tenure?
Not that I'm aware of, Ian.
Okay. I was also interested in the Lost Canyon Stream Bank rehab, and Sam was pursuing getting a stream alteration permit for that. How specifically was that going to help with recharge to those wells that are over there?
There's one well number 5, the furthest downstream, I believe, just has vegetation in the infiltration bank, basically, Ian, that we believe is restricting conveyance of water. So the idea is just to get in there, get rid of that vegetation, get it cleaned up, and try to promote higher flows.
Right on. Cool. And then I had a question. I saw it in Lisa's notes. I don't know who wants to answer it, but Leo Williams retiring. Wow, 20 years. That's awesome. And I know we've talked about that. That's coming up. But how is that transition going with his replacement to take over for him?
It's going very well. Brant Judd has worked under Leo for, does anybody know his exact number, 12 years or something he's been up at the plant?
Wow. So, I think it's pretty close to that.
What was that, Brian?
I think it's pretty close to that.
Yeah, so Brant knows that plant inside and out. We are working on the transition with Brant. I have offered him the opportunity for promotion. We will use our orientation period to make sure it's a good fit both for him and for the district. So as a result of that, we will move Eric Malling, who works under Chris, up to the plant as an operator to backfill Brant's vacated operator position through that trial period. We don't want to hire somebody until we're convinced and everybody convinced that it's a good fit for everybody.
Right on. Thank you. Question for Sam. Is that Summit Park master plan almost done? It sounds like it's due this month, you said.
Yeah, we're pretty close. We just provided final comments earlier in the month, and I think they're going to wrap it up by the end of next week, so we should have it in hand.
And then we can get it to you, Ian.
As a resident, I'd love to read it.
Yeah. Sure.
I haven't forgotten about your request. We'll get it to you as soon as the final stamp's on it.
Right on. Thanks. And then last question's for Brian. It's also kind of related to stuff down that line. So it seems like we've had a bunch of leaks this winter. Is that tied at all to we haven't had a lot of snow, but it's been really cold. Like, are any of these ground issues that we don't have the normal snowpack that we'd have in some of these high elevation areas that potentially partially insulate some of the features?
Yeah, that could have a lot to do with it. We typically go through this kind of a cycle, you know, spring, fall, freeze, thaw kind of thing. So I definitely think that the frost level has a lot to do with the ground moving, because some of these leaks, we're finding frost upwards of 3 feet thick outside of the road. And typically frost is just, you know, mainly in the road, but those Sunpeak leaks, you know, we were dealing with frost that was 3 feet deep out in the dirt on the side.
It's come up in a number of conversations recently that there's a number of folks seeing that. So I was wondering if, yeah, if that's going to exacerbate issues for us, and potentially we're going to have even more leaks with this low
scope. Yeah, I think frost has a lot to do with the amount of leaks we have. I mean, it's a typical cycle. We've had a lot this winter.
Well, thank you.
Kudos to Brian's team. The leak, they had some leaks up in the Sun Peak neighborhood on Bear Hollow Drive that were extremely difficult. These were big leaks. They did a great job, I think, of getting it under control as quickly as they could. We had some angry customers, but in the grand scheme of things, they did an awesome job.
Yeah, I think we've got a SWAT team out there. So, yeah, kudos, Brian. Thank you. That's it for me.
Okay, Tim, how about your questions?
Yeah, well, I got a lighthearted one. I think everyone's doing better on the pictures. I think that particularly on the, leasing attempt at that.
Attempted.
I still haven't seen anything from Steve yet, but nonetheless, I think that
we were up counting inventory up behind the treatment plant outside in a cold garage, and I thought if I was ever going to take a picture to give Tim, this would be the one, and I forgot. So,
Tim, I will get an action photo of Steve for you so Steve can put it in the packet next month.
It's exciting stuff, Tim. It really is.
All right. Well,
spend a morning out there when it's about zero and get a sense of what your guys are going through, because it looked really bad. And just to understand when you see these big glaciers coming out there and you got to go find them and stuff, I think that what your guys did was remarkable. So good job there. With regards to the DocuWare stuff that's going on, I was just wondering if we could get a little bit of a briefing on what is it that does again?
So it's an electronic document management system that allows us to take historical documents, scan them, and make one repository for all this stuff. Currently, they're all in numbered filing boxes spread all over Connex's and all over our upstairs in the office. The electronic filing system will allow us to have all that stuff, all past court stuff, filings, annexations, easements, all agreements, all that kind of stuff, all scanned and be fully text searchable.
Catching up about a month a day or something like that?
I wish, yeah. We're still installing the scanning software on the computers at this point, but we're going to come up with a plan to, how we're going to attack the historical stuff. To be honest, with COVID, with the reduced office staff, it's making it tough. Hopefully, when we get beyond that, we'll have, staff back in the office with time to be able to do that.
I know that this is going to pay off, but it just probably doesn't feel like it every day, does it?
No, not yet. But, moving forward, too, we're going to move the account payable stuff so that all incoming stuff won't be printed. It'll just go through an approval process that is all electronic through this DocuWare system. People will get notices basically, for lack of a better term, an inbox within the software that they have something that they need to approve. They can approve it. It will go back to, in this case, for accounts payable, to go back to Sharon. Sharon will take it. And the final goal is that she'll be able to, it'll basically parse data out of those documents and we'll be able to import it directly into our billing accounting software. So it'll take some steps out and some human error out as well.
And Brian, on that picture, I don't think you put on there, it was about 5 above that morning.
Yeah, I think when we first started, it was below zero, and probably that picture was probably 5, yeah. But all that snow you see is ice from the lake.
Okay. Is that it, Tim?
Yeah, I'm done. Thanks.
All right. Joel, did you have any questions on the department updates?
No, nothing at this point.
Okay. Very good. Well, then that takes us through our agenda. I had one item for the open meetings training is coming up on Thursday, February 11th at 6 p.m. I sent out that invite with the email from the county so we could, you know, you can join in then or do it online. Just needs to be done by February 28th. Yeah, it used to be kind of a fun one to go to. And it's usually, you know, pretty interesting. It's pretty quick. So if the board members could do that, please, that would be appreciated. Do we have any other items?
Nothing from me, Mike.
Okay. Well, yeah, I kind of missed the start here, and did we have a moment to remember Bob when we started out?
We did, Mike. Yeah. We did take a moment to recognize Bob.
His service and how much he, how much he'll be missed. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then with that, at 8:08, we will stand adjourned.
All right. Thanks for everybody's time. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Yeah. Great job.
Night, everybody.